Welcome to the Delmarva Almanac. Each week we connect you to the best of Delmarva. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. This week on our show, we'll meet abstract expressionist artist Barbara Warden. We'll dip into our archives to hear about the history of a few lady entrepreneurs in Ocean City, Maryland. And naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about fall birding on Delmarva. Barbara Warden earned a Master of Fine Arts at the University of Maryland. She was living in Washington, D.C. and starting to make a career as a painter when a divorce diverted her attentions toward more lucrative work to help support her family. She worked for the next two decades for nonprofit groups that advocated for workers, consumers, children, and families. She eventually remarried and began splitting her time between the Mid-Atlantic region and the Bitterroot Valley in Montana. Once her children were out of school, she heard once again the calling to make art. Barbara is now one of the artists at the Studios on Walnut in Milton, Delaware. That's where she and I met a few months ago, and this is what she told me about reviving her creative pursuits.
I decided, you know what, time to go back to my studio. But I didn't want to go back as a painter because I'd been away so long, and I just really felt I didn't know if I could get back into it as a painter. And my husband suggested, well, why don't you look at fabric and become a quilter? And I was such a snob about it. I said, why would I become a quilter? And all I could think of were blue-haired ladies and sitting around quilting. But a friend of mine owned a shop in Montana, and I looked at the fabric, and I realized that that's really what I could do, because I love color. So I started quilting. As a matter of fact, the first class and only class I took was with 8 10-year-old girls, because that was the only class that was being offered. And this was still in Montana in the Bitterroot Valley. So I took the class, and then I just practiced and practiced and practiced. And I worked for a dozen years as a quilter. And I sold a lot of work and had some shows. And then I decided it was time to go back to drawing. So in 2012, I set aside the quilting. For the most part, I do it on commission now rather than building up an inventory. And so I went back to my drawing.
Barbara says that the catalog for a drawing show at the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C. gave her just what she needed to commit to drawing as her primary medium.
The curator selected his drawings, some well-known artists, some lesser-known artists. But in the introduction, he said, drawings can be preparatory for a painting or sculpture. They can stand on their own as a finished piece of art. And when I saw that, I realized, you know, that's really where I belong in my work. When it's finished, and it's a stand-by-itself drawing.
Barbara decided that she wanted a change from the brilliant and diverse color palette of her quilts, and she wanted to create something much more instinctual. She wanted the act of making art to be an exploration unfettered by the constraints of planning them ahead of time.
So when I decided to go back to drawing, I decided I'm not using much color. I really want to go back to black and white. I want it to be as spare as possible. So, and I also wanted there to be a disjuncture. This was fiber in color. This was drawing on paper. And I only use paper. Occasionally I'll use leather, because I really do enjoy drawing on leather. But most of it's paper. And that's a kind of fiber also, but it's different from the fabric I use. I'm a great believer in automatic drawing. And automatic drawing, historically, I think began with the Dadaists in France in the 1920s. And then a number of Americans picked it up later on, and one of them was Ellsworth Kelly, whose work I've always admired. But there were other artists out on the West Coast in New York who were also experimenting with automatic drawing. And I had worked with an artist in California very briefly named Lee Mulliken. And Lee simply put out materials on the table and he said, okay, have at it. There were about 5 or 6 of us sitting down in the evening in a studio in Santa Monica. And I never gave up the idea of automatic drawing. So when I would start a drawing, I'd simply close my eyes at random, pick up a drawing tool, whatever it was, and start drawing. And if I had to, I would erase it. Those were my abrasions on the surface. I'd pick up another drawing tool, work with it. But it was very much at random, very gestural, sometimes more linear and defined. So I wanted to work in a lot of different ways with a lot of different materials simultaneously, and that's pretty much what I've done. I start with a gesture and I end up with a resolution, I think, set it aside, and then go on to the next one.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm Dana Kestrew McCabe, and we're talking to abstract artist Barbara Warden. Barbara's work is inspired by nature, but it is an expression of it, not an attempt to capture its likeness. Her drawings are rich with texture and movement. She recently finished up an ambitious year-long project that portrayed her reactions to a place that inspires her.
I decided that if I was going to draw again, I didn't want to do it piecemeal. And the only way I could figure out to do it and be disciplined about it was to make a drawing a day. So I just decided on the format. It would be small drawings, 5x7, 7x9. And I looked at artists' work, books that I have of artists' work, whether it's Archie Gorky or women artists like Jay DeFeo or Elizabeth Murray, just to see the dimensions that they use. And I figured, okay, small enough is 5x7, 8x10. Those are legitimate dimensions for small drawing. But then I also wanted to have an anchor for each one of the sections that I was going to work on. So there are very large drawings as individual anchors for about 11 or 12 series that I worked on. I was part of a group show at the Biggs Museum. After that show was over, I talked to the curator, Ryan Grover. I took up a whole stack of drawings to show him the direction which I was going, and he said, a few months later, after I showed him more drawings, that I'll give you a date. So the whole focus originated with the years that I've spent in Montana, because there is a beautiful valley south of Missoula called the Bitterroot Valley. We spent 6 months there, 6 months in Lewis, 6 months back and forth for many years, and my husband's from Montana. So I would hike and found a wonderful group of hikers and mountaineers, and we would hike and climb, and it was wonderful. So that became my focus for the 365 days. The first set of drawings in the first month was stone, then came ice, then came rain, wind, restless ground, light, echo memory. Each one was, and I really just wanted for the most part one word, and if I could get one syllable word, then that would be even better. So that became the focus. That every step along the way, I talked with Ryan. We met, he and his assistant Reggie, the three of us, and we talked it through, and he made some suggestions. I asked questions, he gave answers, he asked questions, I gave answers, and it just worked out very well. It was a good working relationship, and it still is. So in fact, I wound up with an inventory when I took everything to the Biggs last February. I wound up with 481 drawings. No, I couldn't believe it. And Ryan said to me, do you know what you have done? I said, no, tell me. So he said, the total is 481. And the Biggs has just been remarkable and wonderful in supporting everything that I've done. And Ryan Grover is an excellent curator. So it's been a very good experience.
Barbara's show at the Biggs Museum in Dover, Delaware was a big success. Her drawing, Memory Wall Echo, from her 365 series, was juried into the September exhibit at the Art League in Alexandria, Virginia, at the Torpedo Factory. And her drawing, Restless Ground 7, was recently chosen to hang in Delaware Senator Chris Coons' office. Visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/arts, to see the video of this interview with samples of her work and get links to her website. It's time for our first break. When we come back, we'll hear about the history of a few lady entrepreneurs in Ocean City, Maryland. The Delmarva Almanac is brought to you in part by the following towns where the arts are flourishing. In Maryland, visit Centerville, Denton, Ocean City, Princess Anne, and Stevensville. And in Delaware, visit Dover, Milford, and Rehoboth Beach. Visit our website for links to their galleries, eateries, and arts-related events. That's delmarvaalmanac.com/artstowns. Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. I'm your host, Dana Kester McCabe. It's been long said that Ocean City's success as a resort can be greatly credited to women entrepreneurs. One of the first recorded was Zipporah Zippy Lewis, who surely knew how to make something out of nothing. In 1845, her husband, a sailor named Jonathan, was tragically lost at sea. Zippy walked up and down the beach, combing the ocean horizon on the chance that she might see her long-lost love return. Eventually, she turned her daily grieving into a source of income to support herself and her five children. She scoured the beaches of what is now Ocean City for the refuse of sunken ships that washed ashore. This was not necessarily treasures of gold and jewels, though she may have occasionally found them. More likely, it was brass fittings and other hardware for boats that could be reused, or household items from shipping crates. For many years, she could be seen pushing an ox cart filled with her pickings, which she took inland to sell. She earned enough money to buy two lots on the island and build a house, which she left in her will to her daughters. Her tenacity and ability to prevail became a part of the mythology of the town. The story so inspired Thelma Connor, one of the city's most successful businesswomen, that a portrait was painted of the valiant widow and hung in the Zippy Lewis Lounge of Thelma's Hotel, the Dunes Manor, which you can still see today. The prevalence of women hotel owners began during the economic boom following the Civil War. Prosperity inspired a number of emerging fads, which had a direct impact on the future of this slim stretch of land along the Atlantic Ocean. Caviar, the roe or eggs of sturgeon, became the quintessential delicacy for the nouveau riche. The waters off Delmarva's coast were thick with them, so commercial fishermen flocked to the region to meet the demand. And taking the family on vacation itself became very popular among the growing middle class. But in Ocean City, it really began with all those fishermen. And they needed places to stay. Naturally, enterprising individuals, many who were women, realized that rustic housing would only attract those who really enjoyed roughing it. Accommodations that would be suitable for wives and children would guarantee a return visit. Most people would want a good bed with clean linens and substantial meals with well-prepared food. At that time, that was definitely women's work. The town grew up on an island which had previously been used mostly for grazing livestock. On the southern end of town were the cottages of the men who worked in the fishing fleet. Northward, a number of boarding houses were built in the early 1870s, including the Rhode Island Inn and Massey's Boarding House. In 1875, a handful of locals, along with a few Baltimore businessmen, opened the Atlantic Hotel on the beach nearby. New Yorkers named Stephen and Rosetta Tabor purchased a plot of land north of them. They called their property the Ladies' Resort to the Ocean. They, in turn, deeded 50 acres of what was then called Sinnepuxent Beach to a group of 105 investors who called themselves the Atlantic Hotel Corporation. The new deed allowed for streets, subdivisions, and individual lots. Among the investors were men and women whose families still have businesses here today. The Wicomico and Pocomoke Railroad Company also bought stock in the venture. They were planning an extension of their rail line to the new community. It was completed not long after, thus connecting Baltimore and Washington to the new resort, which was now being called Ocean City. Many scoffed at the development scheme, but Ocean City's first building boom was off and running. This created a great opportunity for budding hoteliers, many of whom were women. If you think about this as a division of labor, this totally makes sense. In a given family moving to the region, many a husband was planning to make his fortune fishing. While he was doing this, not only did the wife have to fend for herself and her children, but she had to find ways to make money when the fishing was slow or affected by bad weather. Fishing was also dangerous work, leaving a number of women widows, forcing them to go into business, not unlike Zippy Lewis. Rosalie Tillman Shreve was one such widow. She lost her husband in the Civil War. She began renting out rooms in her home out of financial necessity. Rosalie was so successful that she earned enough to buy a second property, a rental cottage. In 1890, she used her profits to build the Plimhemmen Hotel. It had 48 rooms and sat on two lots. It was named for her family's plantation estate in Oxford, Maryland, on the other side of the peninsula. In most cases, the hospitality industry was a difficult life, and the whole family had to pitch in. If you know anyone who grew up in the resort as late as the 1960s, you'll hear about a culture of hard work and sacrifice. Many a local will tell you stories of their first jobs as very small children changing sheets, cooking, and all manner of other chores for the family business. It was commonplace for all the kids to give up their beds for the paying guests and camp out, sleeping on the floor, somewhere else in the house throughout the summer season. By 1926, 30 of the 32 hotels listed in a brochure advertising the resort had women as proprietors. Many of the gals who ran Ocean City's early hotels simply grew into the job. Some were women who came to the resort on vacation, and opportunity beckoned them to stay indefinitely. One such woman was Ella Phillips Dennis. She and her husband came to visit the beach in 1890 because she had been in ill health. She improved quickly and fell in love with life along the shoreline. She built the Dennis Hotel and ran it for the rest of her life. The town's reputation for being run by the women was now well known, and Ella is famously quoted in an interview with the Baltimore Sun saying, "Ocean City is 70% built by women, run by women, and the men are all henpecked." During this era, the leadership of the town was referred to as the Petticoat Regime. Margaret Campbell Buell was the daughter and wife of well-connected Washington, D.C. bureaucrats. She arrived in 1900 to build the Mount Pleasant Hotel, which she promoted among the power brokers in our nation's capital, until she retired to Florida and sold the hotel in 1919 to Susan Dickerson Mason. It was only 10 years earlier that she had left her home in Parksley, Virginia, to get a fresh start in Ocean City. Legend has it that Susan created quite a sensation arriving by boat with all her worldly goods, which included her cow. Around the turn of the century, Willie Jones came to the resort for work for just one summer and stayed, marrying George Connors, the owner of Connors Restaurant, which had been in operation since the 1880s. After he died, she ran and eventually sold it, which enabled her to own a number of other businesses, including building one of the first motels in 1965, the Santa Maria. During the mid to late 20th century, the sturgeon were long gone, but the hospitality industry continued to thrive with a number of successful women at the helm, including Thelma Connor, Anne Schall, and Eunice Sorin. This list does not include a host of other entrepreneurial ladies in real estate, retail, food service, and amusement businesses, among others. Certainly, the men of Ocean City have done just as much to promote progress in the resort. The story just seemed timely with the recent achievement of a woman heading the ticket of a major party in a presidential election for the first time. The reality is that since its beginning, women have been equal partners in the sweat equity required to build this country to what it is today. Ocean City and other towns like it are proof of that. If you'd like to learn more about this topic, visit our website, delmarvaalmanac.com/history, or visit the Ocean City Life Saving Station Museum at the Inlet in Ocean City. And now for some Delmarva dates with history for this time period. On September 22, 1785, during a tropical gale, the brig Nancy, coming from Madeira with a cargo of wine, broke up on the Virginia Capes, killing all but two aboard. And on September 24, 1927, an Army dirigible, also known as a blimp, crashed in the woods 5 miles east of Salisbury, Maryland. It's time for another break now. When we come back, naturalist Jim Rapp will tell us about fall birding on Delmarva.
The best way to experience the waters of Delmarva is by paddling, by kayak, canoe, and stand-up paddleboard. During the Delmarva Paddling Weekend, September 30th through October 2nd, join the expert guides leading trips around Laurel, Delaware, and Snow Hill, Maryland. For more information, please visit delmarvapaddling.com.
Welcome back to the Delmarva Almanac. We're so glad you joined us today. Now here's naturalist Jim Rapp to tell us about the many wonders of fall birding in our region.
Fall migration is picking up, and the Delmarva Peninsula is an exciting place to witness a true wonder of the wild world. Overnight, relatively quiet parks and natural areas can be transformed into bustling open aviaries with songbirds dripping from every tree branch and twig, and shorebirds concentrating in tight, organized flocks on mudflats and beaches. Species not seen since the spring make their annual autumn appearance as they push south to warmer wintering grounds, some traveling as far as Tierra del Fuego at the very southern tip of the South American continent. For birders the world over, Delmarva is on the list of places to bird before you die. There are several reasons for Delmarva's high position on the birding destination wish list. The first is geography. Birds often follow coastlines during migration. The Delmarva Peninsula is right in the middle of the Atlantic Flyway, a major route for many of the Western Hemisphere's most sought-after species. Birds also seem to prefer funnel-shaped peninsulas with a north-south orientation. Each autumn, migratory birds bottleneck near Cape Charles, Virginia, at Delmarva's southern tip, where they rest and forage before taking flight over the expansive mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. The numbers of individuals and species are dazzling. Spend a weekend birding cape to cape in the fall between Cape Henlopen and Cape Charles, and you may likely top 200 species on your bird tally. Another reason Delmarva attracts the birds is coastal habitat and water, water everywhere. Our open bays, rivers, and ponds are home to birds such as osprey, pelicans, terns, and waterfowl, and our marshy and sandy shorelines provide the type of habitat favored by shorebirds, egrets, and herons. Wet woods and bald cypress swamps attract warblers, tanagers, and flycatchers. Migrating raptors can be found in the open marsh and dark forests. Much of this habitat is protected and managed for the birds in our national wildlife refuges, parks, and wildlife management areas. Winds and weather also deliver birds to the peninsula. During fall migration, cold fronts push into Delmarva from the north and west. This can produce migratory bird fallouts when thousands of birds leave the skies to congregate in a small area while waiting for better weather. Some fallouts can be small, such as a narrow, shrubby point jutting out into a bay, while others can canvas the entire peninsula. If strong winds blow from the south, many migrants will wait for days until favorable tailwinds appear to help carry them over the Chesapeake. Heavy storms and fog can cause birds to fly a little too far over the Atlantic, and these cautious migrants will quickly snap back towards the Delmarva coast, where they can wait safely for the bad weather to pass. Delmarva's flat, open landscape, mostly devoid of towering artificial structures that can obstruct and disorient birds, also makes the peninsula a good path for migration and a great place to be a birder. Fall migration actually starts in early summer for some shorebirds, but August, September, and October are peak months for most songbirds and raptors. November and December are when the waterfowl and seabirds arrive on Delmarva's shores, and many of our national wildlife refuges are managed to provide important winter habitat for our iconic ducks, geese, and swans. This is Jim Rapp, and you're listening to the Delmarva Almanac. We're talking about fall bird migration. Typically, big soaring birds, such as raptors and egrets, migrate during the day when they can take advantage of thermals and air currents that provide lift under their large wings to assist them on their journey south. To watch the daytime migrants, check out one of Delmarva's hawk watch sites at Cape Henlopen State Park, Kiptopeke State Park, and the nearby Ashland Nature Center in northern Delaware. Smaller songbirds, such as warblers and sparrows, tend to migrate at night. After a long night flight, the little guys will spend the morning foraging on fruits, seeds, and insects to get their energy up for the next leg of their trip. While feeding, you can get nice looks at these birds, who seem much more concerned about breakfast than any threat posed by a quiet, patient birder. Some species can migrate thousands of miles, nonstop, from departure to arrival. Scientists are learning more about these epic migrations with the help of technology. Using tiny satellite transmitters, scientists with the Nature Conservancy and the Center for Conservation Biology at the College of William and Mary tracked a tall shorebird known as a whimbrel from Virginia's eastern shore to the Mackenzie River in western Canada. This 3,200-mile, presumably nonstop flight was completed in just under 7 days. To accomplish this incredible migration, the tracked whimbrel sustained an average flight speed of 22 miles per hour for the duration of its journey. Whimbrels have one of the largest ranges of any bird on the planet. They breed in the Arctic and migrate to South America, Africa, South Asia, and Australia. They use their long, down-curved bill to probe sand and mud for invertebrates and to pick up berries and insects. On Delmarva, whimbrels gobble up fiddler crabs in our marshes to fatten up on their migration from South America to the Arctic. The barrier islands and marshes of Virginia's eastern shore provide a critical migratory feeding area for whimbrels and other shorebirds. Virginia's eastern shore is a great place to get your fall migration fix, and the local birders have an event planned just for you. The Eastern Shore Birding and Wildlife Festival provides you with a front and center seat to view the migration spectacle with 4 days of guided hikes, boat trips, and free family activities. Vendors, exhibitors, and free activities for families will also be located throughout the weekend. The popular Flight of the Raptor live bird of prey demonstration will be held in Cape Charles Central Park. The festival also includes a traditional Eastern Shore oyster roast in the appropriately named village of Oyster, Virginia. More information about the Eastern Shore Birding and Wildlife Festival can be found on our website, delmarvaalmanac.com. Birds and the wild areas that support them add to the quality of life we enjoy here on the peninsula, but birding is also big business on Delmarva. According to a 2011 report issued by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the participation and spending patterns of 47 million birders nationwide, trip and equipment-related expenses associated with birding generated nearly $107 billion in total industry output, supported 666,000 jobs, and generated $13 billion in local, state, and federal tax revenue. Birders spent an estimated $15 billion on their trips and $26 billion on equipment in 2011. For trip expenditures, 52% was food and lodging, 34% was transportation, and 14% was other costs such as guide fees, park fees, and equipment rental. With roughly one-third of the U.S. population living within a four-hour radius of Delmarva, and assuming that just some of these folks enjoy bird watching, it makes economic sense for Delmarva to invest in our parks, refuges, and the low-impact infrastructure that supports bird-related tourism. We hope you'll spend some time on Delmarva this fall to experience the best of bird migration on the East Coast.
Thanks, Jim. Well, that's all for this edition of the Delmarva Almanac. Be sure to follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and next week join us to learn more about our local culture and get connected to our natural wonders. We'd like to thank our community partners, the Friends of Delmarva Public Radio, and our underwriters for their help in bringing this program to you, our audience. If you'd like to become an underwriter for this program, visit delmarvaalmanac.com/support. Our theme music was provided by Brightside Studio. This show has been a Moonshell production. Thanks for listening. Until we meet again, may the rhythms and tides of Delmarva bring you good fortune.